Paper.
Welcome to episode 76 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Sierra Nevada-based visual artist Andy Tramps, who uses watercolors in wildland forests to create paintings and artist books that explore mystery, reverence, and delight, while grappling with vanishing habitats. Merging the lineages of illuminated manuscripts and natural history field journals with a contemporary art and science awareness, her imagery weaves intricate botanical detail into rich layers of shape, color, and hand-lettered text to evoke the complex interconnections within ecosystems of the greater West. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Andy Tramps, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thanks, Helen.
Yeah, happy Earth Day. We're talking on Earth Day. This won't come out for a couple of months, but I know the Earth is sacred to you, and I look forward to your perspectives and learning more about your work. So let's start talking a little bit about where you grew up and your time spent outside and how artistic influences of childhood.
Sure. Yeah, thank you so much, Helen, for this opportunity to chat together. I've been looking forward to it a lot. I grew up in the Oakland Hills in the East Bay area, San Francisco Bay area, on a little street in a fairly wooded area. When my parents built the house, there were only two other houses there. Now, of course, it looks entirely different. But when we were growing up there, it was a fairly densely wooded, unpopulated, kind of wild place.
Yeah. I have to say my mother grew up in the Oakland Hills also.
Really?
Yeah, but she was, I'm not sure if her parents built their house. It was a more developed area. Obviously, I visited it much later, actually after the big Oakland fire in the 90s. And we kind of walked around. I was with a friend and we found her house, which had been leveled.
Oh my gosh. So that gives me a sense of where she lived.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's still
okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So my parents were, I'd say they had a lot of creative energy, but they weren't specifically using it other than house, making a house beautiful, and gardening. Mm-hmm. They were both really into plants and gardening, just for fun and beauty, not for any kind of livelihood. And my mom had been a music major when she went to college. So music was a big part of childhood, and I took piano lessons, but definitely did not divert in that direction at all. It didn't take.
Me too, yeah.
I love having that awareness.
Yeah.
You? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, did your mother have a profession? Just curious.
No. Okay. No. My mom was a total homey person throughout mm-hmm. her entire life. Mm-hmm. She loved her quiet, beautiful home. And I have to say, me too.
Yeah. And what about your father? What did he do?
So my dad had been in a sequence of different family businesses.
Okay.
So I think one... I am self-employed, my brother's self-employed, my sister-in-law, and looks like my niece is going to be also. One of my grandfathers, or both of my grandfathers, had their own businesses, and one of my grandmothers had her own business, and so did my mom's sister. So my dad's first livelihood was working with his uncle and his father as a general contractor in the East Bay. And then my father and my grandfather ended up having a grocery store. And then when my grandma died, my dad took over her business, which had been selling tickets. So like entertainment, opera, football.
Okay.
Symphony. Uh-huh. ice follies, the whole thing.
Yeah. So. And how was that done during that time? Like door to door or?
Yeah, there was a little box office where I started working in the fifth grade.
Uh-huh.
And tiny little office with zillions of drawers with little tiny slots in them for all the actual paper tickets.
Wow.
That would be picked up and delivered all over the Bay Area for different events. That became one of my jobs in high school, to drive the tickets around, to pick them up, drop them off the day of a show. So it was really a fun thing, and I think very formative to have worked with my grandma and her three close friends. Mm-hmm. They were older women when I started working, and they just took me right in and trained me up on, you know, how to do a check deposit. You know, all that stuff that if you have a business.
Yeah, you have to do
a lot of skills to learn. So.
Okay. And I think you learned about the book form in sixth grade.
I did. I had an amazing sixth grade teacher. She taught us calculus. She was just a phenom. And one of the things that we did was we bound a book. I think it was probably 9 by 12, maybe even a little bigger.
Mm-hmm.
We just used paste. It's very crackly, but I still have it somewhere. Mm-hmm. Kind of corduroy around the spine and hand stitched.
Wow.
Pages together, created, you know, signatures and stitched them together.
And you wrote and illustrated it as well, right? It was a whole story, a whole book of your own.
Your own content, anything you want. Wow. So some people had poems, some people had nonfiction. Mine was called Andy's Fantasies. Uh-huh. Just little stories, you know, with mice and then drawn mice or whatever. There's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
And then the other thing about books in childhood is that one of my grandmas always gave us the Caldecott and Newbery award-winning books. So we were exposed throughout childhood to a lot of reading and taking in of books, sitting in laps and having that sort of special, intimate experience of before you could even read, of just the pleasure of the object of the book. And its specialness. And then, of course, that morphing later into just your own falling into other worlds through the book form.
Right. And you mentioned this is you and your brother, right?
Yes. Yes.
Younger or older?
Younger, just by about a year and a half, very close in age. And, you know, I'm older, maybe by the time we were 9, we were equal in size, and then he shot past me. So, you know, physically we were peers pretty early on, and I'd say emotionally became peers probably in college. We were actually college roommates, but he was my sidekick for roaming around the hillsides and forests where we grew up.
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to get back to that and tell me a little bit about that. And I have this childhood memory of going to visit one of my mother's high school friends, so in Oakland, Berkeley, somewhere. And it may have even been another town, but, you know, my mother and her friend hung out, and I was maybe 12 or 13, and she had a daughter similar in age. And I remember going into the woods, and that we could climb from tree branch to tree branch. It was so dense, and there were enough branches that you could just stay up off of the floor.
Yeah.
And it was so cool.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of the East Bay Hills that span Albany, Berkeley, Oakland, down into San Leandro and Hayward and beyond. There was a regional park district and water district established really early on. So there's this huge expanse of open space. So we could walk, you know, through some neighborhoods and then enter into those open spaces. And yeah, the trees are amazing. Monterey pines, Monterey cypress, a lot of eucalyptus that had been planted that I think have been eradicated quite a bit now. Mm-hmm. Lots of oak trees. And yeah, we did that too. Hopped from tree to tree, and we had swings and
Cool.
Part of the world. Mm-hmm.
And so, tell me about your college experience and sort of how things developed.
Yeah, well, before that, I have to say high school. So I had some amazing teachers throughout my education. I was very fortunate. California at the time was number one in the country for its rating for education, public education. Now it's like in the 40s, I think. Really bad. Wow. Anyway, I was lucky.
Yeah.
And in high school, the first Earth Day happened, 1970.
Oh.
I was a senior and I made the poster for my high school, which has a poppy and a redwood tree on it. And it's, I posted it on Instagram last year. I'll repost it today.
Oh, cool.
So I just mentioned that because, you know, I was making a poster, I was doing art, I was illustrating plants and trees, and I was learning about environmental politics and the topics of the day. It was, you know, being in the Bay Area in California, it was really a prevalent topic of discussion already. That's why there was Earth Day.
Right. And tell me when you got started drawing and painting. Was that younger?
Yeah, I was, I mean, some of my earliest memories are taking coloring books outside and sitting on the ground and coloring and writing onto the colorings or coloring over the writing, just, you know, having those two things come together as they do in a lot of coloring books. There's a story being told. And so I would add my own words. And so that morphed into a love of diaries and keeping journals and calendars. And then eventually that sort of morphed into field journals and sketchbooks and taking those outside. When I went camping with my brother, I would always have art supplies and sketchbooks with me. And for a very long time, I would write in one from one direction, and then I would flip it like a flip book, and that's where the drawing and painting would go. So for a while, I sequestered those things, and then eventually that barrier dissolved.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then in college, I was really fortunate to have, I was in the art department. That's what my official degree is in. I went to UC Berkeley. The art department was at the time very abstract expressionist oriented, and I was drawing pictures basically. I didn't really fit in very well, but I found my way into the design department and they had a year-long course. And my professor there really early into the game recognized that I was doing something that I could actually be employed doing, which is scientific illustration. So he really gave me free rein to study and do projects independently. He'd give me prompts. I didn't have to do what everybody else was doing unless I wanted to. He was very supportive of me developing an independent practice. And that was really cool. I got to go take courses from the life sciences illustrator at Cal Berkeley, who had this little tiny medieval studio office space in the like attic of one of the old life science building. He was kind of a weird old guy, but he taught traditional scientific illustration through the extension. So that's when I really started to get some actual skills that would fit into a livelihood and a practice.
Yeah. And we have to talk now about Red Cliff, Colorado, where I have my studio, because I think you came to Red Cliff in college, right?
I did.
And we discovered that somehow in one conversation.
Well, when I learned that you lived in Red Cliff or had moved to Red Cliff, I was like, nobody in the world knows where Red Cliff is.
I don't live there, but I have my studio there.
I see. Well, I want to know about that.
Yeah. Well, you start first because you were there first.
All right.
So in the 70s?
Yeah. And So I started college in 1970, and right around 72, 73, I was a little unsure. This was before I took the course, the year-long course with a design instructor. I didn't really fit in the art department. I was still having a struggle with whether I wanted to study science. So I was taking a lot of natural history classes, and I just needed a breather. And so my boyfriend and I, he kind of wanted a breather too. And we ended up going to Colorado and getting jobs in Vail, which was having a construction boom at the time. So we both worked in construction, made big bucks for the time, and lived in tiny Red Cliff, which was a harrowing commute in the wintertime up and down that mountain. What's that mountain called? I forget.
Battle Mountain.
And miners coming and going at the time. And it was a really interesting choice to make. But we really loved living in the mountains and worked hard. And then we'd ski out the door, cross-country skiing, backcountry skiing, and I would paint. I sat in the snow. I had an Insulite pad and sat in the snow and painted. So that was our break. We were there, I'd say, right after Christmas time, and came back in the early summer for summer school at Cal.
Okay, yeah. And just to set the stage, Vail became a ski resort. It's very different than all the other ski resorts in Colorado, which were here. Vail was built in the 1960s. So this was, I'm not surprised there was a boom in building. Everything was just sort of starting, like public schools, because people were living here, and gas stations, and, you know, all these things were, and people building homes and second homes. And
yes, the village was intact and all built up. But it was the other side of the freeway where we were mostly working. And it was condos, like miles of condos going up in grocery stores and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Well, we ended up here because my husband, we were living in Portland, Oregon, and he was working for a company that produced the City Magazine, you know, the Portland Monthly. They didn't need him anymore, but he kept in touch with them, and they ended up purchasing some magazines in Colorado and needed an editor. So they offered that to him, and we had actually met in New York City and were choosing between Colorado and Oregon as a place to move. And we moved to Oregon. And then, so this felt like, okay, let's do Colorado now. So
I just kind of wanted to live there anyway.
Yeah. So that was 2012. And then I didn't know what I was going to do. We didn't know where we were going to live or where I was going to have a studio. And I had all my papermaking equipment, so I knew I needed something eventually. And I met someone who, she entered my name into my children's, you know, school directory. I signed up, and my email address was HelenHebertStudio.com. And she paints. So she got curious, looked me up, sent me fan mail. And she had a studio in the old schoolhouse, which that was probably a school when you were there. I think it closed in the 80s.
In Redcliffe?
Yeah, in Redcliffe.
In Redcliffe, yeah.
So, yeah, it has been art studios since then. It's very small. Redcliffe only has 250 population. So there are only like four studios there. And one thing just led to another, and I have an amazing studio there. I was really fortunate to find that, both for the space and the size and the price that I pay, because it is off the beaten path. Yeah.
It is. And it's also just so beautiful a place.
Yes, it is.
And it sounds like it's sort of remained much as it was, unlike probably almost everywhere else you could go in that area.
Yeah, it's a mix. It'll be interesting to see. And, you know, the ski industry keeps trying to do things, and people fight against it. That would make it more of a thoroughfare. But it's just kind of off the beaten path. So it's managed to stay. But there are some probably million-dollar homes there. And then there are shacks.
Yeah.
We lived in an old mining town. Yeah.
Yes. Well, when we lived there, it was all minors and us.
Yeah, and then the mine got closed because of arsenic or something. So yeah, there's been a lot of change.
Yeah.
So anyways.
Oh, that's so fun. That's like, who would ever, it's just, I hope to come and see your studio in Red Cliff one day. That's definitely.
That would be fun.
Something
yeah.
I would like
yeah.
to do. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's move on to, so sort of how you work, and it sounds like you've camped your whole life and sort of drawn outside. And I want to hear about wherever you want to start with that and your materials and the papers you use and the books you make.
Yeah. So, I did end up working as a graphic designer and a scientific illustrator for a long time throughout my 20s. Well, you know, even that first Earth Day poster in 1970, I was just a teenager. So that went on well through my 20s and partway through my 30s. And it morphed eventually into a business that I had called Larkspur Graphics, where I published my illustrations as note cards and posters. And it started out just doing promotional posters for clients that I worked with. And then people wanted to buy them. And I thought, okay, I'll make more. And it just sort of was one of those unplanned evolutions of a livelihood. And so throughout that, I was outside all the time whenever I could be. And I always kept sketchbooks and field journals. But I saw that process as a building source material for the careful kinds of illustrations that I would do indoors, ink on Mylar, ink on paper, very careful, detailed, persnickety kinds of work. And for a long time, I was really happy working that way. And then I began to work with a distributor. I began to experience people wanting certain types of illustrations from me. And also the rise of Barnes and Noble and Amazon started to happen, which was changing the whole small bookstore gift shop that was the bones of my whole way of making a living. You know, $50 orders. I was filling them myself for the longest time. Then suddenly I had a distributor who required a $500 minimum. All those little places fell by the wayside. Everything started, small started going away and big started taking over the universe. That was going on too. But I think also deep within, I was starting to have a longing to do some other kind of art. And I had always called myself an illustrator, but I wanted to call myself an artist. So I just stopped being able to make those kind of illustrations. And I have a very close friend who suggested I apply for an art residency at the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology on the Oregon coast.
Yeah.
And I went there for 4 months and my whole life was changed forever. I was keeping field journals. I had the same kind of plan to work outside, come into this beautiful studio that they had granted me, and make finished paintings there. I didn't know what they were going to look like, but I wanted to make paintings. And what happened was I just kept working outside every single day, no matter what. I did not, given the option to work any way I wanted, which was what the residency was giving me permission to do, and actually almost demanding that I figure out another way to be in the world and see if I could be an artist. I just, every day, I didn't want to be in the studio. I kept working outside. And through that opportunity, my whole process transformed from seeing the work outdoors as source material and research to seeing my work outdoors as my actual art practice, and to find a way to do that so that I could create artwork outdoors that would happen almost entirely outside, that the only finishing things like binding or gold leaf or, you know, one last bit of gouache, that happens inside, but it's a tiny, tiny part of the process for me. So that's when that changed. And I think that was 2004.
Okay. Yeah. Sitka is an amazing place. And they still have residencies for those of you listening who are interested. It's a wonderful place to go. And I've taught there. I've never done a residency. Okay, cool. So yeah, describe a little bit about being in nature and painting outside and what you bring and how you bring it and how you prepare.
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, now that you know that background of doing this really careful, tedious, I mean, I call it tedious now. It wasn't tedious until it was.
Right.
But doing that kind of careful work, I can still sort of veer into that direction. So I'm really interested in finding ways to bring more wildness into my process. So I love doing things like using found twigs just off the ground and dipping them in ink and paint and drawing with them, spritzing the water, letting rain fall on the paper so that when I make marks with paint or twigs or brushes, it doesn't do what's expected. It does something else. Right. And those kinds of processes give me sort of a door to walk through to allow a little bit of chaos and spontaneity. And then I love interacting with that.
Right.
So that's one aspect of how I work. And then I would say the other aspect is that I'm also in an interaction with place. So I'm just so enchanted with certain kinds of habitats, and my way of experiencing them more deeply or deepening my connection to place is through drawing or painting. So when I'm looking at a branch really carefully, I just feel like the external world is becoming part of me, part of my body, by actually using my body. I mean, sometimes I'll draw in the air. And I feel like that brings the physicality and the beauty of what I'm seeing into my body. And then I also feel, not to veer too much into the bougie-woogie, but I do feel like something of me goes out into the forest or into the birds that I'm listening to. I feel like it is really actually an interactive experience. And that's a really important part of it all for me too.
Oh yeah, I can relate to that. And I, so I want you to just, or I have a question. Just when you go, do you sit there for a while? Do you have sort of a meditative practice? Do you have an idea of what you're going to paint, or do you find that as you're there? Because I really feel, as an artist myself, some things just come to you. And I spend a lot of time in my brain, but I really appreciate what you're saying, because I can sort of feel it, like that, oh, this is happening right now. This is what I want to do. So.
Yeah. So I love those questions, Helen. Thank you. And I do think, you know, we are both nature girls. That's pretty obvious. Yeah. There's a resonance there for sure. Yeah. I really, really love and need to go unplanned.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously I'm choosing where to go. But once I get somewhere, and I guess I should back up a little bit, I try to go to the places that I want to reach for as long as I possibly can. And as far, I choose places as far away from roads as time and energy allow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I'm at home here, I can walk out the door. We have a trail system. So that's for a few hours or maybe all day. But my husband and I do expedition backpacks and sea kayak trips where we go for a week, 10 days, up to 3 weeks. at a time. And so that really allows a lot of meandering. So then back to what happens when I actually get out to a place and how do I get to work? Once I decide where I might settle in for the afternoon or the day, I put my stuff down and I wander around and I'll kind of crouch down low and look around in different directions, watch the light and listen. Really often I will hear a bird and it's like, oh, there's my spot. There's just every single time I allow what Bruce Mao calls aimless drifting to just sort of let the wind blow you around, I land somewhere that really feels like that's where I need to be. So then I get to work and I have lots of different kits. So if I'm going somewhere all day and I don't have to carry overnight gear, I have a pretty large setup that I'm willing to carry, but I could never backpack or fit into a kayak. So that's one kit. I have a little tiny backpacking kit. My sea kayak kit is halfway in between. So how far away I am from a road kind of sometimes determines the project or the process because it's tool dependent. So I usually have a lot of different projects going on at the same time so I can choose what I'm going to take out there with me accordingly.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about the Paper Advisor, a place where you can discover my most popular papermaking and papercraft resources, including information about tools and supplies, how-to videos, and paper tips, all in one place. You can ask the Paper Advisor your paper questions there, too. And best of all, it's free. Find the Paper Advisor by going to HelenHebertStudio.com and looking for the free Paper Advisor link in the upper right-hand corner. Now back to the episode.
I know you make these accordion field journals. What do you call them?
Maybe the series you're thinking of is In Forests.
In Forests, okay.
Yeah, that was the, I haven't done any in that series in a few years now.
Okay.
But they were the first real artist books that, you know, I felt like, yeah, I'm making an artist book here. And they were made with folded sheets of paper, folded into folios so that I could carry them around inside a little folio carrier that I make out of corrugated plastic because it's really lightweight. And so then I can carry around folded sheets of paper. And sometimes they're quite large. And sometimes they're just teeny, but I do love accordions and I use them in various forms. The biggest ones were done as individual folios that I then connected to create these large accordions. Yeah.
Okay. I guess my question I was getting at was, how you decide what you're working on. Do you have any, and maybe you don't have any foresight into what it will become? Because I know you do sell your work to special collections libraries. We've crossed paths at Codex. Or does that just organically happen?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So that first series, the In Forest series that are the large accordions, I actually just started working on individual folios without any idea how they might get bound. If they would ever get bound. I saw them as sort of field journals, loose leaf field journal pages with an as yet uncertain binding form, if ever bound. And I think at some point along the way, I've developed a trust in my process having an openness to it. It's really important to me to work that way. And so I spent several years generating those folios before I determined the form they would take. Mm-hmm. And it kind of bothered me that I didn't know for a while, but I also knew that I would eventually know, and I did. So I have lots and lots of different projects going at the same time. Many of them are accordions. They're just, sometimes they're even rolled up long sheets of paper that I fold later and work on unfolded, but mostly they're folded simply because it's really easy to carry paper that's folded. You can carry a big sheet of paper if you fold it.
Yeah, so, right. And tell me some of your favorite papers to work with.
Early on, I learned about Arches Text Wove. It's also called Velin, V-E-L-I-N. And I learned about that from calligraphers. It's very sturdy and folds beautifully, but it's too lightweight for anything very large, unless it was were to be stitched. But for an accordion structure, it doesn't have enough weight. So I also work on watercolor papers, and they mostly don't fold very nicely. Mm-hmm. So that's been a problem, but I've stumbled into it and tried different papers. I love painting on Arches papers, but it's really crappy for folding. Fabriano folds better. Lighter weight sheets fold better than heavier. And I'm experimenting with Saunders papers now. And they fold really nicely. So.
Okay. Yeah. And are you're just working directly on the paper? You mentioned the twigs. Talk a little bit about your inks and whether you do anything with sizing. I think you mix some of your inks, have a binder. Just want to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, I have been working with sap for a while now, tree sap. Mm-hmm. I was a number of years ago, I was inside, you know, those giant sequoia trees. They'll have caverns sometimes where they burn from the middle, but they're still really healthy and surviving. So I was inside one of those and there was sap dripping along the burnt part of the tree, and I touched it. And there were little beads of it. So I took some of the sticky sap and I put it in my hand. And then I was just wandering around the forest. And after a while, I opened my hand and the sap had dissolved in kind of my sweaty, warm palm. Mm-hmm. And it looked sort of like blood. It's this beautiful sort of brownish red. Mm-hmm. And it's water soluble. Mm-hmm. And so then I connected the dots with gum acacia, which is the sap of an acacia tree, and that's the binder used in watercolor paint. So I thought, oh, I'm going to paint with tree sap.
Yeah. But
so I do dissolve a giant sequoia sap when I find it, and you can paint pretty directly with that, though it's kind of weird and squirrely because it's sticky and gritty and so I've done different experiments, adding different things to it. And then I have yet to find another kind of tree sap that will dissolve in water that way. Most of them require alcohols or solvents, other kinds of solvents to dissolve. And I do love painting with them because they are shiny.
Right.
And they also create translucency the way beeswax does on a thinner paper. So there's some really... For you, with looking at light, I've been trying to figure out, well, how could I hang these so that you can see the translucency in the paper? But lanterns would be really
cool. Yeah, that's a cool idea. Yeah, I do not do any kind of surface techniques. So it's so funny. I do watermarks in the paper I just haven't gone in that direction at all. Talking about that, let's talk a little bit about your forest prayer flags. And I think those relate to the time we're currently in. And I love this picture I've seen. I think they're just hanging in your own yard. But the idea of these beautiful prayer flags hanging right there in the forest. And yeah, tell me about that project.
Yeah, I did hang them up here around the woods near our home. And I'm hoping when I have finished this first sequence of them, that I'll be able to show them and have some kind of event in the outdoors where they're hanging outside. You know, I think that would just be wonderful. I don't know how or where yet. But yes, the whole idea behind them has been very personal and also, I think, also public, in that this last year has felt like an explosion of things that we've been sort of leading up to culturally for a long time. So environmental degradation. Last year were the horrors of the pandemic and catastrophic wildfires mm-hmm. in the West. Racial and sexual injustices are suddenly in our face culturally and coming to the front of our conversations in a way that hasn't happened in a very long time. It kind of resonates for me with when I was young and when the first Earth Day happened and environmental awareness and awareness of racial inequality and sexual inequality was really part of a daily conversation. And it kind of simmered in the background more for a while. Yeah. But it's really inescapable, important for all of us right now. And there's a huge sadness and grief that's part of all this. And for a long time, painting in the forest and exploring in the outdoors for me has been about joy and delight and biophilia, which is love of living things, mm-hmm. and just reveling in the pleasure and delight of birdsong and wildflowers and giant trees and mountains and being able to hike through places like that. But over time, I have been noticing that while I'm working, this sadness just will descend upon my process like a cloud. And sometimes I just cry and I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I started doing was just writing those kinds of thoughts into my paintings. So that's sort of the field journal quality mm-hmm. of the painting practice for me. And then I just decided I really wanted to have a specific project that would address grief as well as delight, that I just needed a way to do that. So that's what the forest prayer flags are. And I decided I wanted to incorporate some science. So I've been interviewing scientists. I have a series of questions. Almost all the scientists do their work in forests in the West. And so I'm attaching a scientific concept to each prayer flag in the making of it. It's not a scientific illustration. It's not obvious by looking, but the titles are things like "For the Mysteries Beneath Our Feet." Mm. And so that prayer flag is having some imagery and writing in it that will address mycorrhizal fungal relationships in the soil and different plants that are connected to each other underground and the current science that is exploring that. Other ones, tiny plants beneath enormous trees. And that one will talk about biodiversity in terms of forest structure. Mm-hmm. And so then I also want to have a book that I'll create that will have an image from each prayer flag, describe the science, the scientific concept, suggest an action a person can take that's positive, a way to grapple, do something. And so that's the sort of overarching plan. The palette has been really somber. I'm using wildfire charcoal and tree sap and Sumi ink mostly. And it's I'm experimenting for the first time with Kozo paper.
Oh.
So that's what I've been working on.
And do you buy that on a roll? Or do you buy sheets, large sheets?
So far, I've been buying large sheets and tearing them in half down the middle. So I have these long, they're about 13 inches wide and about 40 inches long.
Okay.
And I am going to start, once I settle in on a favorite paper, I'm going to start using roll stock. And I'll probably be mounting them to a larger sheet, but I'm not sure. They're kind of scroll-like, so that's something I'm exploring and don't know much about yet and want to learn about.
Right, and I think I saw a picture of how you do it, but talk a little bit about how you carry these and then work on them in the forest.
Yeah, so I knew I wanted to work bigger for these, and I liked the idea of them being long and skinny this way for some reason. And so obviously rolling up large sheets of paper, that works great. I can carry that with ease. But then when I would put it down on the forest floor, it's really bumpy. And I tried standing and working with a big stick with my paintbrush attached, and I do that a little bit, but I needed to figure out how to have a smoother surface underneath the paper. So I have a corrugated plastic folding folio that folds small enough to fit into my pack. And then I have these giant clamps and a tripod. So I have a really ultralight tripod that I use also for an easel setup, an outdoor easel that I have that screws onto it. So I set up the tripod in the forest, and then I lean this unfolded 40-inch long, 13-inch wide corrugated plastic setup, clamp it on there so that it doesn't bend, and then put a piece of wool felt, which is the traditional way to do sumi ink on paper, and then the paper on top of that.
Right.
Paint with
wonderful
ink, lots of different brushes, and
And we'll put images of Andy's work with the show notes that everyone can go look at, so you can see what we're talking about. I wanted to go back to sort of your business model now, because you talked about the note cards and other posters and things you were selling. And I know you teach now and you sell artist books. I don't know if there's anything else. Just kind of, an overview.
Yeah, I'd say my livelihood is sort of an even split, or it has been until this last crazy year. Half my income would be from teaching and half from selling original artist books and paintings. And that's been the model for a long time now. I was really fortunate in that right after I figured out how to bind those first pages, I went and showed my work at the very first Codex, and a collector came by, and I sold my first artist books then and have been ever since. I met Vampentramp,
right, and
Bill Stewart at that show, and so I've been very fortunate to have an outlet for this stuff that I'm making, that who knew? I had no idea that I could survive this way.
Right. And your paintings, do you show in galleries, or how do you sell them?
They mostly get sold through word of mouth and direct contact with me in occasional exhibitions. I don't have one gallery. I do show regularly in group exhibitions, and my stuff usually sells that way, or people find out about me and ask for work.
And I wonder, this is just coming to me now, whether you could tell me something that people say about your work, because what I'm thinking is you're right there in it. You're painting in the forest and your leaves are big on the page. You have this one, I think it's a accordion book, but I'm not sure, where you're just showing part of the trunk of the giant trees. So you really get a sense of being in there, just like you were when you're painting it. And I wonder what kind of comments you get. You could talk about light also. and wildness, whatever. You have so many wonderful aspects to your work.
I love hearing that, because the idea of it feeling like you're there, that's for me the whole point. I'm really interested in the experience of being immersed in a place, mm-hmm. of feeling very small. Mm-hmm. Like I go places where I know I am potential prey. I think mm-hmm. it's really important. Mm-hmm. I think it's a problem culturally that we dominate. We yeah. think we can dominate nature. We can't. I mean, nature's going to eat us alive if we don't figure out how to be a friendlier neighbor to our fellow beings.
Right.
Pandemics will take us away. Fire will take us away. The heating up of the planet will remove humans. If the earth needs to, we'll go away.
Right.
Anyway, that's a whole nother tangent. But it's really important to me, the experience of feeling immersed, and I want to share that. And what I hear a lot from people who look or hear about what I'm up to is it brings up their own longing for that too.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about that. And when I teach, I notice that too, that people really, or when people walk by and I'm painting, people are really drawn. They're aware. It resonates for them that there's some magical aspect, that there's a special connection potential, that when we are still and quiet and really look and our tiny little selves dissolve into something bigger, that really is transforming and wonderful to experience. So I think people, they seem to recognize that that's going on in my paintings and for me, and they want that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's, I think, more important to me to transmit than anything else. It's just to try and encourage others to take that time, set your phone down, you know, yeah. be quiet and still and silent. See how
yeah.
that
Yeah. Yeah. And I think people probably, you know, sometime in their life, whether it was as a kid playing outside or going on a camping trip or whatever, have had a taste of that, but they don't continue to do it over and over like you do. So it's part of your daily practice. And yeah, there's something really seductive about that. So we need to wind down, but I did want to hear sort of something about your approach to teaching, just whatever comes to mind. Are you telling people how to see? Or are you setting the stage with, I don't know.
Yeah, you know, it's mostly what we were just addressing, which is the idea of quiet and stillness.
Mm-hmm.
And I have people write a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And people are initially, I thought this was a drawing and painting class. You know, why are we writing? But as soon as people start writing, they have so much to say.
Yeah.
Everyone's so busy all the time. And when I give people permission and encouragement to address whatever it is they're experiencing when they sit down in a beautiful place outdoors or in a difficult urban habitat, wherever it is, everyone right now, always, forever, senses beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And wants to address beauty and delight and joy. And everyone has grief and sadness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just think it's really, really important to allow both into our lives and to articulate them with image, with word, through art, through writing, through conversation, to not pretend that everything's okay, but to address what's difficult and look at clearly in the face,
mm-hmm.
try to do something about it. But like Wendell Berry says, see if I can remember his exact words, be joyful though you have considered all the facts.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we all have a right to joy. And so to get back to teaching or making art, I think, you know, it's really important part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me one of the formats that you teach in. I know we're hopefully coming out of COVID, so it's not really happening now, but you take people out into nature, right?
Yeah, well, of course, I love that more than anything. And everywhere that I do that in my teaching in these just amazing places that I get to take people for classes, everyone's still shut down. But I have been over the last, since the first of the year, I'm teaching online Zoom classes, and they're very fundamental techniques for working in a field journal. Mm-hmm. So that's been a really fun thing to do. People from all over the world can come because it's on Zoom.
Yeah.
And they're very basic techniques. It's just 2 hours. And it's really important to me right now to teach in a way that's empowering and inviting. Mm-hmm. And so that's been primarily what I've been up to in the teaching lately.
And so what are they looking at something that they paint? Are they just making marks? I'm just curious.
Yes. Yes. So I encourage people to have a window if they can, or also to bring things inside, twigs, mm-hmm. leaves. Our last class was drawing and painting leaves and petals, flower petals. Uh-huh. Having actual objects, subjects to look at is an important aspect, because you can form a sense of connection, even just looking at one leaf.
Right.
It happens. Yeah.
Okay. And I wanted to get to your recommendations. So you said your favorite tool is the paintbrush. I know that's like a wide, you kind of indicated that you use different kinds of things as a brush, but you have a couple of absolute favorites, and we'll put these in the show notes too. So tell me about those.
Yeah, my favorite tool of all time is a very large round sable watercolor brush. So a sable brush, it's natural hair. They're beautifully, a big one will have a really fat belly and a beautiful tiny tapered tip. Mm. That's the mark of the perfect brush for me, mm-hmm. which means you can mix up huge amounts of paint or ink, and the brush can be just dripping with paint. And then you can begin to paint and have very large marks. Or if you manipulate the brush and twist and play with it and lift, you can create delicate, tiny, fine marks too. So it can just be really quite fun and sensuous and beautiful tool to work with. Yeah. And so there are a couple brands. Did you want me to mention those, Helen? Or just put them in?
Yeah, you can just say them real quick. So yeah.
There's a brand called Creative Mark Rhapsody. And that's the best deal for the best quality brush, sable brush right now that I have found. And then the next one down that I really like is the Winsor Newton, not the Series 7, but it's called the Winsor Newton Professional Artist Sable Watercolor Brush. And they come in a wide range of sizes, and you can get a pretty big one. I like to use, I have a number 20 and even bigger. A 10 or a 12 is a really great size. If you haven't used a big brush yet, get one of those. Right. And then synthetic brushes, the problem with them is that their tips degrade. They don't hold as much juicy paint, but there are some really nice ones of those too. And I think I might've shared the Princeton Velvet Touch brushes. Did I? Maybe I did.
No, but we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For a synthetic brush, which is a fraction of the cost of a sable brush. Those are my favorites these days.
Awesome. And then you wanted to recommend cave paper.
Oh, yes. In fact, just because I'm going to make noise by doing this, but I have to show you these, even though nobody else can see. I was taking a class. I was a student last night with San Francisco Center for the Book, and we builded onto cave paper, which I had not tried. Cave paper, I just feel like you can do anything to it. You could run a truck over it and it would still fold beautifully. Right. I make cases out of it. It's so sturdy and it's so earthy in its feeling and in its colors. I just think it's a wonderful paper. It's kind of weird to paint on. But I have been experimenting and look forward to more of that.
Yeah. And Cave Paper was in Minneapolis, but it's recently moved to Tucson. They have a new owner. But I think they're still making the same basic line of papers. Yeah.
Well, and that's really exciting. I mean, it's like the second generation of paper. I'm so happy that happened.
Right. And you do have a list of your favorite tools and materials if people sign up for your email newsletter on your website. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. So if you go to andytrams.com, there's a contact page and you automatically, if you sign up, will receive that list. But you can also just email me and I'll be happy to send it to you if you don't want to sign up. That's okay too.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I do think some listeners might be interested in these two words. You mentioned biophilia, I think, and then solastalgia.
Yeah, solastalgia. I only learned about that about 4 years ago or so at a conference. Solastalgia is a word coined by an Australian environmental philosopher. His name is Glenn Albrecht. And I believe you're going to share his information too. Yeah, he's a living, breathing, current person, writing fascinating books and papers. And solastalgia, he's defined, one of his definitions is that homesickness you feel for your home land, your home habitat that is no longer as it once was. Mm-hmm. So I have a feeling almost everybody understands that concept and has experienced it. There's hardly anywhere we can go in the world that hasn't been negatively impacted by human practices. So it's an important word to embrace. I love that there's a word for this feeling because we need it, to articulate around it.
Right. And we'll link to his blog. And then biophilia was the rich natural pleasure that comes from being surrounded by living organisms, which is what you are doing and trying to get people to do.
Yes.
Wonderful. And there's a book.
By E.O. Wilson, the amazing scientist still living and working. But I believe it was originally coined by Eric Fromm in the early 1900s.
Psychologist, right? Eric Fromm, I think, was.
Yes. Yes. I'm forgetting names of his books. It's Fromm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And and I think that's just, we're born with that.
Right.
We come out of the womb.
Right.
Loving, rolling around in the grass and smelling flowers and loving our mother's bodies and all that stuff.
Well, Andy, it's been a treat to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on Paper Talk.
Likewise, Helen. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season.